You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Folks, tonight I'm going to embark on a course from which there is no return. It is important that you learn the information that I'm going to begin to impart to you tonight. And yes, it is a part of the Mind Control series. It's also a part of the history of the Illuminati in this nation. And it will explain an awful lot of things to you that have never been explainable before. It's going to explain to you the link between the lodges of the Illuminati, the intelligence community, and the underworld. It is extremely dangerous what I'm embarking upon, simply because so many people who have attempted to reveal this history previously have been killed in the process of doing it. I have no fear, and I will finish what I start, or someone will, because it needs to be done. Tonight I begin to narrate to you a special report of the Executive Intelligence Review entitled The Ugly Truth About the ADL. Now, I want you to understand something. I am not talking about Jews. I am talking about a branch of the Illuminati, the control structure that is bringing one world government into fruition, destroying the sovereignty of nations, and many, many other things. As you will see, ladies and gentlemen, the ADL does not represent the Jewish people, but instead is using them and is manipulating them so that they innocently, as many of you have done throughout your life innocently, are helping to bring about the destruction of the sovereignty of individual nations, the destruction of individual creator-endowed, constitutionally guaranteed rights, and the formation of a one-world totalitarian socialist government. I want it clearly understood that the Hour of the Time has stated on many, many occasions that we oppose racism of any kind, in any form, by anyone. What you're going to discover is that the ADL, while calling many, many people anti-Semitic, are themselves one of the greatest racist groups that has ever existed upon the face of this earth. On April 14th, 1865, the day President Abraham Lincoln was shot, will live forever, ladies and gentlemen, as a day of infamy for American patriots and lovers of freedom all over the world. But for the leadership of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and the Order of B'nai B'rith and its 20th century secret police arm, the Anti-Defamation League, April 14, 1865, is a day that will be long remembered for a very different reason. The B'nai B'rith, a pivotal player in the British Freemasonic plot to destroy the Union, was implicated in Lincoln's assassination, something that you've never been taught. That fact does not square very well with its long cultivated but totally unwarranted reputation as a Jewish social service organization and a champion of civil rights. For that reason, B'nai B'rith and the ADL have gone to great lengths, ladies and gentlemen, to bury that history and much, much more. Simon Wolfe, 1835 to 1923, was the Washington, D.C., lawyer for the Order of B'nai B'rith during the entire period of the United States Civil War. He would later head the International Order of B'nai B'rith for many years. In 1862, Wolfe was arrested by Lafayette C. Baker, the chief of detectives for the city of Washington, D.C., and later Lincoln's chief of the United States Secret Service, on charges that Wolfe was involved in spying and blockade running on behalf of the Confederacy. Baker arrested Wolf, who was the attorney representing a number of Jews accused of spying for the South, on the grounds that he was part of a conspiratorial organization working on behalf of the secessionist cause behind the lines in the nation's capital. The conspiratorial organization named by Baker was the B'nai B'rith. Both Baker and United States General Ulysses S. Grant targeted the Order of B'nai B'rith as a Confederate spy agency. Upon taking command of the Western Front in 1862, General Grant issued Order No. 11, which expelled all Jews from the military district within 24 hours of its implementation. U.S. Grant was no anti-Semite, ladies and gentlemen. He was reacting to the activities of B'nai B'rith and leading Confederates like Judah P. Benjamin. Lincoln, however, cognizant of the need to avoid blanket attacks against religious or ethnic groups, rescinded the order, which was the proper thing to do, for all Jews are not members of B'nai B'rith, and B'nai B'rith was not solely at guilt. The Civil War was actually engineered and brought about by British intelligence through their arm of the Illuminati in the United States, headed by Albert Pike, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, whose headquarters at that time was in Charleston, South Carolina. In 1987, B'nai B'rith authorized biography of Simon Wolfe by Esther L. Panitz offered the following highly suggestive, albeit incomplete, description of Wolfe's personal relationship with President Lincoln's assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Now bear in mind, folks, that this biography, written on the basis of B'nai B'rith's archives, written on the basis of B'nai B'rith's own archives, paints Wolfe in the most favorable of lights. The mere fact that the author had to include Wolfe's links to Booth and Wolfe's earlier arrest as an alleged Confederate spy and blockade runner implies that the actual story is far uglier. I quote from the history of the B'nai B'rith. Wolfe's concern for culture first expressed itself in the formation of a private club devoted to the arts and humanities and frequented by young men avid for learning. Were pride and ambition his only motives in seeking the intellectual life? Clearly, Wolfe hoped that if he and his friends would devote themselves to the pursuit of learning, they would deflect the prejudicial statements of their Christian neighbors. Wolfe was upset that terms such as money changers, cotton traders, and clothes dealers had become words of reproach. Locally, the group's theatrical productions received a good press. Wolfe, who would often play the ghost in Hamlet or Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, bore an uncanny resemblance to John Wilkes Booth, Lincoln's assassin. Earlier in Cleveland, Booth had joined Wolfe and Piazzotto in dramatic performances. Years afterward, Wolfe remembered that he had met Booth once again at the Willard Hotel on the morning of the day Lincoln was shot. There at the bar, Booth explained that Senator John P. Hale's daughter had just rejected his marriage proposal. Wolfe attributed Lincoln's murder to this personal tragedy in Booth's own life. Wolfe also recalled that once he sat for a picture entitled, quote, "The Assassination of President Lincoln," end quote. In his own book, ladies and gentlemen, entitled Presidents I Have Known, Wolfe says that he and his longtime acquaintance John Wilkes Booth did some drinking together at the Willard Hotel on the day Booth shot Lincoln. Wolfe's and a second leading B'nai B'rith figure, Benjamin Pixoto's, dealings with John Wilkes Booth were hardly cultural. Nor could Wolfe have possibly believed that Abraham Lincoln was killed because of John Wilkes Booth's unrequited love affair. Even John Hinckley, the would-be assassin of President Ronald Reagan, was declared insane when he tried to peddle the line that he had tried to kill Ronald Reagan due to an unfulfilled fantasy love affair with actress Jodie Foster. To understand the circumstances under which B'nai B'rith's Washington, D.C. leader and one of its founding members were circumstantially tied to the Lincoln assassination conspiracy, and explicitly linked to the secessionist insurrection against the Union, it is necessary to look briefly at the circumstances under which the Order of B'nai B'rith was founded in 1843. Following the American Revolution, the British monarchy and its East India Company colonist apparatus never for a moment abandoned their commitment to reconquer the lost colonies in North America. Although the military effort at reconquest in the War of 1812 failed, other efforts to seed the United States with British agents, some drawn from the ranks of anti-Republican Tories who were permitted to retain their citizenship and property in America under the terms of the Treaty of Paris of 1783, were more successful. In 1801, the Tory faction of United States Freemasonry, the grouping of Freemasons who had sided with England during the American Revolution, opened up shop as the Grand Council of the Princes of Jerusalem of the Mother Supreme Council of the Knights Commander of the House of the Temple of Solomon of the 33rd degree of the ancient and accepted order of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry in the United States. This United States-based British Freemasonic Lodge was chartered in Charleston, South Carolina. The members of this British-led secret society would direct the Confederate secessionist insurrection a half-century later, and other Scottish Rite members would be among the founders of the B'nai B'rith. They, too, would be leading Confederates. Apart from the esoteric mission of spreading an explicitly anti-Christian form of Roman pagan worship and occultism among the early generations of American citizens, the Charleston Lodge also sought to build up a network of pro-British merchants, spies, and politicians in both the North and the South, who would one day play a pivotal role in the reconquest. Many of these early Masons became wealthy through their business dealings with the British East India Company and the Dutch West India Company in both the cotton and the slave trade. Among the founding members of the Charleston Scottish Rite Lodge were many prominent Jews, including Isaac de Costa, Moses Cohen, Israel de Lieben, Dr. Isaac Held, Moses Levy, and Moses Pieczoto. Many of these men, ladies and gentlemen, were Sephardic Jews from North Africa or from Spain, who had originally settled in the Caribbean and engaged in the early slave trade. These Jewish Masons set up their organizations, which also maintained active liaison to Great Britain's powerful Jewish community. The Hebrew Orphan Aid Society was one such nominally benign group that would produce one of the most rabid secessionist leaders, Judah P. Benjamin. Although today any reports of the Freemasonic roots and structure of B'nai B'rith are usually greeted with a torrent of allegations of anti-Semitism, back in the formative years, B'nai B'rith's own magazine, The Menorah, offered the following information about the founders of the group, and listen to this very carefully. Quote, "Their reunions were frequent, and several of them being members of existing benevolent societies, especially the Order of Freemasons and Odd Fellows, they finally concluded that a somewhat similar organization, but based upon the Jewish idea, would best obtain their object. The Jewish religion has many observances and customs corresponding to the secret societies known to us. The synagogue, for instance, might be compared to a lodge room. It used to be open twice a day. For a Jew desiring to find a friend, they had but to go there and make themselves known by a certain sign and token. The sign consisted of a grip with a full hand and the magical word Shalom Aleichem. The mezuzah on the doorpost was the countersign. Shema Israel, hear, O Israel, was the password." End quote. Indeed, to this day, all local chapters of the B'nai B'rith are referred to as lodges, a practice borrowed whole cloth from the Scottish Rite. When Moses saw some Jews of this B'nai B'rith type who tried to make their religion into a pagan secret society, he took the calf which they had made and burned it in the fire and ground it into powder. And Moses returned unto the Lord and said, "Oh, this people have sinned a great sin and made them gods of gold." The majority of Jews in America during the first generations following independence were opposed to the idea of a Jewish Freemasonic secret society. Most Jews are ordinary people like all of you listening and don't know anything any more about what's happening in the world than you do. They are lied to just like you are lied to. They are deceived just like you are deceived, and they are easily manipulated because throughout the history of the world, they have been chosen as the scapegoat, as the enemy. And because of that, they can be easily led by organizations such as B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation League. Israel Joseph Benjamin, a noted European Jew, in his memoirs 3 Years in America, 1859-62, wrote of the B'nai B'rith that, quote, "This is a secret society like the Freemasons, with passwords and the like, and was quite a new phenomenon for me. Still, I think the existence of such a society not at all necessary," end quote. He was right, ladies and gentlemen. The secret agenda of the B'nai B'rith, like that of the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite, was to destroy the Union and pave the way for reconquest. The ultimate goal, one world totalitarian socialist government. You see, B'nai B'rith is not the synagogue. B'nai B'rith is not Jews. B'nai B'rith is not Judaism. B'nai B'rith is just another organ under a different name of the ages-old Illuminati, who practice the ancient mystery religion of Babylon in secret. They call themselves the Great White Brotherhood, the Brotherhood of Man, the Illumined Ones. And if you've listened to our series on Mystery Babylon, you know the rest. Two leading B'nai B'rith allied figures would serve as exemplars of the strategy for permanently dividing the Union. One was Judah P. Benjamin and the other August Belmont. Benjamin, who lived from 1811 to 1884, was born in the British West Indies to Sephardic Jewish parents who moved to Charleston, South Carolina in 1827. He was inducted into the Charleston Hebrew Orphan Aid Society, one of the precursors of the B'nai B'rith. After attending Yale College in New Haven, Connecticut, he was forced to drop out under a cloud of scandal. Benjamin surfaced in New Orleans, where he quickly won the patronage of John Slidell. Slidell, a United States senator who would later play a pivotal role in the Confederacy and sponsored the career of August Belmont, who married Slidell's daughter. With Slidell's assistance, Benjamin became a prominent attorney, even serving for a period of time in the United States Attorney for New Orleans. Benjamin gained notoriety for covering up the growing terrorist activities of the Scottish Rite-sponsored Knights of the Golden Circle, while serving as the local federal prosecutor. In 1852, Benjamin was elected United States Senator, a post he retained until the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861, when he resigned to serve the Confederacy. Benjamin was the first Confederate Attorney General. He later served as Secretary of War and Secretary of State, ultimately running the Confederate Secret Service on behalf of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. And as the Mossad does today, he used innocent Jews in the North who were opposed to the dissolution of the Union to furnish information to the intelligence arm of the Confederacy. Judah Benjamin escaped to England following the defeat of the Confederate secessionist plot. It was Benjamin's Confederate Secret Service which organized and supervised such figures in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln as John Wilkes Booth and his accomplice, John Surratt. Benjamin was charged with sedition for the Lincoln assassination, although he was never brought to trial due to his protectus status in England. With the help of a leading Rothschild political asset in England, Baron Pollock, Benjamin continued his legal career in London. He never abandoned his commitment to subvert and destroy the American Republic. However, as a wealthy lawyer for the British merchant oligarchs, Judah Benjamin collaborated with other exiled Confederate and Masonic strategists in England, such as James D. Bullock and Robert Toombs. Benjamin's continuing preoccupation with defeating Reconstruction is indicated in letters he wrote back to the United States with complaints such as these. Quote, I have always looked with the utmost dread and distrust on the experiment of emancipation so suddenly enforced on the South by the event of the war. God knows how it will all end, end quote. And then he went on to say, quote, the South is kept crushed under Negro rule. I can never consent to go to New Orleans and break my heart witnessing the rule of Negroes and carpetbaggers. Nothing is so abhorrent to me as radicalism which seeks to elevate the populace into the governing class. End quote. And that indeed is the sympathy of all of those who call themselves illumined. You see, we are all nothing but cattle, stupid animals, and they are the only ones who have truly mature minds, and thus are the only ones with the right to rule. The Ku Klux Klan, none of you were ever taught this, but it's the truth. The Ku Klux Klan, KKK, was founded in Tennessee in the late 1860s by the Southern Scottish Rite leadership under Albert Pike. The KKK drew its membership from the pre-Civil War Knights of the Golden Circle. Judah P. Benjamin's early role in sponsoring and protecting both the Knights of the Golden Circle and the Ku Klux Klan offers a crucial insight into the B'nai B'rith. ADL's later role in fostering the revival of the KKK in the post-World War II period. We shall return to that sordid tale, ladies and gentlemen, later in this series of broadcasts. Another Rothschild and B'nai B'rith ally who enjoyed the political patronage of arch-Confederate John Slidell, August Belmont, was Judah Benjamin's northern counterpart, a private secretary to the British House of Rothschild who arrived in New York City from London in 1837. Belmont rose to the chairmanship of the Democratic Party, a position he held for 20 years. Belmont was a leading advocate of free trade and states' rights, both cornerstones of the British Reconquest scheme. Prior to his emergence as a leading figure in the National Democratic Party, Belmont worked closely with the Charleston, South Carolina B'nai B'rith in fomenting radicalism among Americans' youth. The effort was in this case run directly by the Mother Lodge of the Scottish Rite in England, then under the command of Britain's Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston. At Belmont's behest, Charleston's B'nai B'rith leader, Edwin de Leon, wrote a pamphlet in the early 1850s entitled, The Position and Duties of Young American. De Leon, whose family were slave traders, B'nai B'rith founders, and later leading Confederates, peddled free trade and openly advocated a strong Anglo-American alliance. While by today's standards the appeal for a strong Anglo-American alliance may seem palatable to some, back in the middle of the 19th century, this was borderline treason. Ladies and gentlemen, the phone is ringing off the wall as the fanatics try to get through to deny this. It is the truth. The original research was done by the Executive Intelligence Review. CAGI has duplicated the research down to the T to make sure that this material is true. And it is absolutely 100% legitimate and historical truth from beginning to end. And that's why the ADL and B'nai B'rith has never sued the Executive Intelligence Review over this report. Belmont's Young America members were among the draft rioters and radical abolitionists who disrupted Lincoln's Union war mobilization to the benefit of the Confederacy and England. During the early phase of the Civil War, England tried repeatedly to intervene into the conflict with ceasefire plans that would have ensured the permanent dissolution of the Union. During the Civil War itself, while the majority of American Jews sided with the North, make sure you understand this, folks, so you know that this is not a racist or anti-Semitic program or report. The majority of American Jews sided with the North and fought valiantly to preserve the Union. The B'nai B'rith was predominantly pro-Confederate. Even in New York City, the lodges preached secession. The Baltimore Hebrew congregation, founded by Dutch Jews who made their money in the slave trade, heard sermons by Rabbi Morris Raphael and the following. And he said this, quote, "Who can blame our brethren of the South for their being inclined to secede from a society under whose government their ends cannot be attained and whose union is kept together by heavy iron ties of violence and arbitrary force? Who can blame our brethren of the South for succeeding from a society whose government cannot and will not protect property rights and privileges of a great portion of the Union?" End quote. Following the Civil War and the assassination of President Lincoln, many of the Jewish slave and cotton traders from the South, typified by the Lehman Brothers, moved to New York City and became prominent in Wall Street banking and stock brokerages. With the defeat of President Lincoln's Reconstruction Program following his assassination, President Andrew Johnson pardoned the Scottish Rite insurrectionists. Now listen to this closely. President Andrew Johnson pardoned the Scottish Rite insurrectionists, including General Albert Pike, and accepted a rank of 32nd degree in the Southern Jurisdiction Freemasons. That was his reward. Suspected Lincoln assassination plotter Simon Wolfe was also absolved of any criminal culpability for his wartime activities. Only non-Freemasons and non-B'nai B'rith were prosecuted for the crimes they committed during the Civil War. The legacy of British Freemasonic treachery against the Union survived intact, including the B'nai B'rith. Although the slave trade nominally was banned in the United States as a result of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, a new form of slavery had already been launched by the British East India Company and its Scottish Rite directors, including the same Lord Palmerston who had played so pivotal a role in the secessionist insurrection. Keep dialing, you blithering idiots. I hope your fingers start bleeding. I'm not going to answer the phone until the program is over. This is really funny, folks. This is going to be done. I'm tired of the lies. I'm tired of the deception and the manipulation of all of you people out there. I'm tired of you peddling off fantasy for truth. I'm tired of our children growing up never knowing what the reality of the world is and never having a chance for the future because of it. I'm tired of seeing blacks manipulated. I'm tired of seeing whites manipulated. I'm tired of seeing Jews manipulated. I'm tired of seeing American Indians manipulated. I'm sick to death of it, and there's not a damn thing that you can say or do that will stop this broadcast or the ones to follow. And you better get that through your stupid thick heads. ADL is up to their neck in it. They stink from it. The new form of slavery was drugs, opium. Henry Carey, one of the architects of Abraham Lincoln's Reconstruction Program and a leading proponent of the American system of political economy, warned about Britain's opium war against China and India in his 1853 book, The Slave Trade, Domestic and Foreign. Get the book and read it. He described the trade in, quote, "that pernicious drug opium," end quote, as, quote, "one of perfect free trade," end quote. Defeated in the secessionist insurrectionist plot, Britain and its fifth column of agents in both the North and the South would eventually regroup around a strategy for running an opium war against the United States. As the reader will learn in later chapters, the B'nai B'rith and its Anti-Defamation League secret lodge played a central role in the drugging of America. Let's fast forward to 1992, folks, in the nation's capital, where B'nai B'rith lawyer Simon Wolfe conspired on behalf of the Southern slave trade. The streets in many parts of town are dominated now by drug traffickers whose deadly poison has inflicted both a subculture of addiction and violence, and a spread of AIDS among the predominantly black population. Community-based efforts led by the Nation of Islam have begun to roll back that new subculture of slavery and despair, restoring safety and dignity to some of the most desperately poor neighborhoods in the United States. And as soon as they began to be successful, they came under attack by the ADL. True to its history, the B'nai B'rith ADL intercedes to turn back the clock to the days of slavery. For drug addiction is a form of euphemistic slavery, and those who are addicted are subject to the whims of those who have enslaved them. They can even control the which way society goes, ladies and gentlemen. You see, if they want to create more crime in order to take rights away from the people, indeed, to make the people scream to have their rights taken away in order to take the fear away, get the crime and the drugs off our streets, they just elevate the price of the drugs so that the poor addict cannot afford to pay for them. So he has to go out and steal and rob and mug somebody and even kill to satisfy the terrible craving of his flesh. You never thought of it that way, did you? But it's true. Want to make it look like the police are succeeding? Want to make a politician look good? Lower the price of drugs way down to almost nothing and crime disappears overnight. One of these days you'll begin to understand how we've all been enslaved for most of our lives. All of us. Caucasian, Jew, Black, Indian, Oriental, it doesn't make any difference. We've all been lied to, we've all been deceived, we've all been manipulated, and we've all been puppets on the end of somebody's strings. It is the purpose of the hour of the time to stop that. I'm not so foolish as to think we're going to be successful and stop it all. But we may be able to stop most of it. And we may be able to hang those that are responsible by their neck from a lamppost until they're dead once they've been legally apprehended and tried by a jury of their peers. Once the truth is known. But the Illuminati, ladies and gentlemen, not the Jews, is in control of the judicial system. The Illuminati, Freemasons, sit on the benches of every court in this nation. First, ladies and gentlemen, when this happened, the ADL set off a massive wave of anger and resentment in the African American community when in June 1992 it published The Anti-Semitism of Black Demagogues and Extremists. The widely circulated ADL report is a frontal attack on the Nation of Islam's and its leader, Minister Louis Farrakhan. It openly threatens retribution against any elected officials or political activists who associate with or publicly commend the Nation of Islam. I've commended them many times on the Hour of the Time and will continue to do that. I condemn them for their racism, but I applaud them and admire them for what they have done for the Black community. No one else has done so much to bring them up out of poverty and give them a sense of self-worth and bring their families together and where they stay together. No one else has taken the drugs off the streets like the Nation of Islam. In July 1992, a major uproar developed in Washington, D.C., when the ADL, ladies and gentlemen, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, was caught red-handed in an ugly attempt to shut down any government contact with what has been the only effective effort to clean up drug and crime-infested areas in the nation's capital. The Nation of Islam's now famous Dope Busters. If you've investigated what happened in Waco, Texas, ladies and gentlemen, you always run up against the ADL and B'nai B'rith. They instigated it. They brought it into being. They promoted it. They pressed it. And they are the ones who released the lies to the press around the country that kept the American people in the dark. When Washington, D.C. Mayor Sharon Pratt Kelly issued an official proclamation honoring Nation of Islam leader Dr. Abdul Alim Muhammad for his leadership in the Dope Busters campaign and for his groundbreaking work in treating AIDS patients with Imuviren, an African-developed anti-AIDS drug, the ADL went absolutely insane. They had ignored these people until they began to take the drugs off the streets. Make sure you understand that. Kelly was repeatedly hit with ADL-organized delegations demanding that the proclamation be rescinded lest she too be identified as an anti-Semite. And this is how they blackmail leaders and police chiefs and mayors and military officers into doing their bidding for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic. You've all learned you can call me whatever you want. Doesn't make any difference. I'll tell the truth no matter what. Always. Always. When she refused, the ADL engaged in a national barrage of media attacks against the Nation of Islam. The attacks culminated in an article run in the Washington Times, co-authored by ADL National Director Abe Foxman and fact-finding director Myra Lansky Boland. Ultimately, Kelly succumbed to ADL demands and issued an open letter to the community in which she continued to praise Dr. Muhammad's work against drugs, violence, and AIDS, but condemned alleged anti-Semitic statements attributed to him by the ADL. You see how it works, folks? She caved in because she was afraid she wouldn't be reelected mayor in the next election. She lost my respect. She probably lost a lot of people's respect. But she doesn't care. Her political career is safe. What was really at the heart of the Washington Times article, which was otherwise a potpourri of outrageous and unsubstantiated charges against the Nation of Islam, was a demand that Congress defeat the major appropriations bill for the Department of Housing and Urban Development over the question of whether HUD rules should permit a HUD contractor to hire the Dope Busters to provide security for a federally subsidized housing project in Los Angeles. The ADL was particularly upset about the national attention the successful Dope Busters drug eradication program was getting. The Dope Busters were founded in Washington, D.C. in 1988. Since then, unarmed Dope Buster patrols have been able to eradicate drug trafficking at the street level in 9 Washington ghetto neighborhoods and private housing projects, completely and totally disrupting the plans of the Illuminati to control those people. They've done this with no deaths and very, very little violence. Exemplary of the success of the program is the Mayfair Mansions housing complex in Northeast Washington. Mayfair Mansions went from an ugly, unsafe, open-air drug market in 1988 to being a handsomely restored, safe, vibrant community as a result of Dope Buster patrols. When HUD Secretary Jack Kemp visited Mayfair Mansions earlier this year, he admitted that the Nation of Islam's Dope Busters deserved the credit and indicated that he was open to granting the patrols federal government contracts. Actually, it wasn't this year. Ladies and gentlemen, it was in 1992. Tenants in public and private housing projects from New York to Baltimore to Los Angeles are demanding Dope Buster patrols. In most cases, the idea has the support of local police and government agencies who have failed to find any other effective way to curtail the intensifying pattern of drug trafficking and violence. In almost every case, the ADL has attempted to block the tenant's choice of security force. The tenant leaders who refuse to back down have been subjected to threats, harassments, break-ins, and other forms of intimidation. This time, however, the ADL may have committed a fatal error in launching such an open and vicious attack on the Nation of Islam. Dr. Abdul Alim Mohammed is not only a leader of the Nation of Islam, he's one of the most respected community leaders in the Washington area, and his pioneering work against AIDS is gaining him international recognition. The black and Hispanic communities in the United States are disproportionately infected by the deadly virus, but have had almost no access to the accepted treatment, which consists of the prohibitively expensive and highly toxic AZT, DDI, or DDC, and as we've revealed on this program, those drugs may really be the cause of death of AIDS patients. Dr. Mohammed and New York City physician Dr. Barbara Justice have reported dramatic success in treating more than 600 patients who are HIV positive with immunovirin, the drug they brought back from Kenya. The pair is also credited with bringing vital information concerning this new treatment modality to both the general public and the medical profession. Taking the point in a courageous effort to avert what would otherwise be the worst Holocaust to hit the human race. Similarly, the ADL's charges against the dope busters carry little credibility and leave the ADL completely exposed as nothing more than a protection racket for the drug cartel. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the truth. The dope busters enjoy the intense support of the communities they serve and have an unprecedented record of success. Wherever they go, the dope busters convey an unmistakable message of hope and inspiration to the community that the war on drugs can be won. Interviews with the residents of the communities served by the dope busters make clear that they believe that it is that message and nothing else that has made the Nation of Islam and the dope busters a target of ADL attack. In a community where the twin plagues of drug addiction and AIDS are the most visible vestiges of slavery, the ADL has shown that despite the passage of time, its true loyalties lie with the slave masters. Now, in 1985, the ADL proudly gave its Torch of Liberty Award to Las Vegas businessman Morris Barney Dalitz. You don't know who that is, do you? The award ceremony, a strictly black tie affair, was given front page attention in the league's monthly bulletin, which praised Dalitz as a great philanthropist who had donated generously to the ADL over the years. Dalitz's generosity was motivated by a lot more than an impulse to help out a favorite charity. As one of the most important figures in organized crime over a period of 60 years and as a lifetime right-hand man to organized crime's 20th century chairman of the board, Meyer Lansky, Mo Dalitz was well aware of the fact that the Anti-Defamation League was from its founding a powerful secret arm of the Illuminati, the go-between between the National Crime Syndicate and the respectable arms of the secret organization that is out to control the world. Without the ADL's undaunted public relations work on behalf of organized crime, the United States would have never been flooded with illegal drugs, and gangsters like Dalitz and Lansky would have long ago been carted off to the penitentiary. Dalitz was one of the kingpins of the Prohibition-era bootlegging business. And he, along with three other gangsters, Morris Kleinman, Sam Tucker, and Louis Rothkopf, ran the Cleveland underworld. Their self-described, quote, Jewish Navy, end quote, smuggled rot-gut whiskey across the Great Lakes from Canada into the Midwest United States. Now, don't get all carried away by the term Jewish Navy, because the Irish gangsters called themselves the Irish whatever they were called. It's human nature. On the Canadian side of the lakes, the booze was manufactured by the Bronfman gang, led by Sam and Abe Bronfman. second-generation Romanian immigrants whose father had been brought over to Canada by the B'nai B'rith Allied Baron de Hirsch Fund and had set up a string of whorehouses. Sam and Abe used their Pure Drug Company, which was established with the help of the Hudson's Bay Company, to manufacture illegal whiskey during the Canadian Prohibition, which was 1915 to 1919. When Canada legalized booze after learning their lesson, and the United States instituted its ban a year later, not having learned anything, they were all ready to become the major suppliers to the gangsters south of the border. United States government documents, these are government documents from the Prohibition era, claim that over 34,000 Americans died of alcohol poisoning drinking the Bronfman brew. Not from drinking alcohol, folks, but from drinking this specific brew. It was poison. Today, Sam Bronfman's son Edgar is a national commissioner of the ADL and the head of its powerful New York appeal. And we'll pick his trail up later, for he's dirty too. Following Prohibition, Mo Dalitz became the undisputed crime boss of Cleveland, expanding his criminal operations, gambling, labor, racketeering, money laundering, tax evasion, from Hollywood and Las Vegas to Miami. One of his Miami investments, a night spot called the Frolic Club, was a joint venture with Meyer Lansky. When Lansky moved into Cuba to open his first offshore gambling, narcotics, and money laundering haven, Dalitz was brought in as a privileged partner. When Lansky and the other directors of the National Crime Syndicate decided that his longtime partner, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, had become a liability and had to be assassinated, it was Dalitz who assumed the lion's share of Siegel's Las Vegas casino interests, interests he still holds, ladies and gentlemen, today. Lansky and Siegel had formed the original Murder Incorporated, otherwise known as the Meyer and Bugsy Gang, to enforce the creation of a national crime syndicate overseeing the Prohibition-era illegal liquor and narcotics traffic. From the very outset, Dalitz had been a member of the National Commission of the Crime Syndicate. Up until Lansky's death in 1983, Dalitz was a regular visitor to the crime boss's Miami Beach condo and was widely presumed by law enforcement officials to be one of the primary heirs to Lansky's crime empire. Now, just 2 years after Lansky's death, Dalitz was publicly surfaced as an ADL philanthropist. It was a sign of the times. By the beginning of the 1980s, decade of greed, drug money, narco dollars had already replaced petrodollars as the primary source of liquidity to fuel the stock market and real estate speculative bubbles facilitated by the Carter and Reagan administration's deregulation of the banking, savings and loan, and brokerage industries. As the power of drug money grew, so too did the political and financial clout of the ADL. Junk bond swindlers like Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken and dope bankers like Edmund Safra, not to mention Mo Dalitz, regularly poured millions into the ADL war chest. In return for this largesse, the ADL publicly branded anyone who challenged the clout of organized crime as a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semite. The lionizing of mobster Dalitz was the ADL's way of boasting that their public relations work over a 70-year period had paid off. But things were not always so easy. You see, the ADL had been founded shortly after the turn of the century as a Jewish defense arm of the B'nai B'rith, the nominally Jewish secret society sponsored and controlled by the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, with its headquarters in the Temple of the Supreme Council of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, just 13 blocks from the White House in Washington, D.C., and by some of the leading British and American white Anglo-Saxon Protestant families, including the Bush family. B'nai B'rith, Washington, D.C., Representative Simon Wolf, the man whom Lincoln's Secret Service Chief Lafayette C. Baker had arrested as a Confederate spy and Union blockade runner during the Civil War, was now working closely with President Theodore Roosevelt in mobilizing Jewish American support for the overthrow of the Russian Tsar. According to Wolf's 1918 autobiography, he had met secretly with President Roosevelt at his Sagamore Hills estate in New York and had launched an international drive to brand the Tsarist regime as anti-Semitic. After a series of meetings and correspondence with Russia's Prime Minister Count Sergei Witte, arranged by Roosevelt, Wolf had denounced the Russian regime for reneging on its promises to curb anti-Jewish pogroms, after which American Jewish organizations, led from behind the scenes by the B'nai B'rith, began funneling guns to the anti-Tsarist insurrectionists. Thus, B'nai B'rith played an active role in the Russian Revolution of 1905 and the formation of the Soviet Union. This activity would lead to widespread allegations that prominent American Jews were pro-Bolshevik. The Warburg family of Kuhn, Loeb, and Company did fund, it's a matter of record, V.I. Lenin and Leon Trotsky, and father and son Bolshevik agents Julius and Armand Hammer, who helped found the United States Communist Party, did actively spread the Bolshevik cause in America and spent a decade in the Soviet Union following the 1917 revolution. These allegations of pro-communist sentiments, while grounded in well-publicized, scandalous actions by prominent Jewish families, missed the mark. In fact, the plot to bring down the Tsar and install the Bolsheviks in power in Russia served long-standing Illuminati and geopolitical interests of the sort advanced by the Scottish Rite, and Britain feared the development of a Eurasian alliance among France, Germany, Russia, Japan, and China based on economic cooperation and facilitated by the building of a transcontinental system of railroads linking the East to the West. Such a transcontinental railroad system would render Britain's domination over the seas relatively unimportant. We'll continue this on Monday. Good night, and God bless you all.